Welcome back to the Engineering Entrepreneur Podcast, episode 156. And as always, your host, Scott Tersey, who runs the best CAD design site out there, in my opinion, humble opinion, CADdesignHelp.com. All right, let's go over housekeeping. Go to my website, CADdesignHelp.com, sign up, send you a free PDF. When you get on the list, the email list, there'll be a little pop-up that comes up. Just sign up there. I still have my online course. I haven't had a lot of new students lately, but you know, that'll tell you all the tips and tricks I've learned over the years on how to become, you know, from a corporate engineer to an entrepreneur like myself. A lot of good stuff in there. That's again, a link on the website, the Engineering Entrepreneur course. I do want to learn. Our host David gave me asked like, "Who's my audience?" And I don't get a lot of feedback. So I check my iTunes reviews, and I don't see a lot of new things. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you've never left a review or a comment, go ahead and do that, because that's going to help me learn, you know, what type of shows to produce and how to run it. And you know, I've been doing this for almost 10 years, I think, at least like 7 years, I think. And I like to, you know, improve it. So if I can get feedback from people listening, that would definitely help. All right. So anyways, on to our guest, who is David Hirschfield. And he's
Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going? Let me finish the intro with you here. So he's a software developer veteran, 35 years doing this. He's got a unique perspective on startups, technological innovation, and business growth. He's worked for some big companies before his first startup, which he sold. I think it was back in 2000. And then since 2007, he's been running techies. It's sort of like me. He's doing freelance software development, basically, for people. But he's got a lot going on with AI. He's a strategic advisor specializing in AI-driven workflow transformation. So I'm pretty interested in AI myself as well. I think that's like the next big thing. Like, we had cryptocurrency, and obviously before that, you know, the internet and everything like going on, but I think this AI is the next big thing. So definitely want to hear some about that. But David, thanks for coming on. Let's go. I always like to hear somebody's background, like, you know, let's say college on, what's your life story? What's the big things that happened to get you from there, like, to where you are today?
Okay. Well, in college, I majored in physics, and then I didn't take your typical physics path. After that, I went to work for a mainframe software company called Computer Associates, and I went into sales. And I became a top sales leader at Computer Associates
Let me ask you why you would do that. Like, why would you go and you studied all this technical stuff. Why would you go into sales?
Well, I really enjoyed it, but I did not like the peer group. I mean, it's one thing if you're, I guess, an engineer. But if you're a physics major, you're with the nerdiest people in the university. I went to UCLA.
I'll correct you right there. The engineering people are super nerdy.
Oh, really?
No, well, 100%.
Oh, that's very funny. That's 100%. Funny. Well, I was trying to imagine, okay, this is going to be my career. This is going to be my peer group. Is this, you know, are these the, and I love the intellectual discourse and digging into a lot of the problems, but is that how I wanted to develop my life socially, you know, in the future? And I thought, you know, I like people, I like sales, I like computers. And so it was very easy for me to go get a job with a big mainframe software company. Back then, it was all IBM mainframes, and with a physics background. So that's why I went into sales, and I did really well in sales. For several years, I was my regional leader the first year. Then I was the divisional leader the second year, and I was national sales leader my last year in sales with Computer Associates. And then I left there to go to work for Texas Instruments. And at Texas Instruments, we were selling again in sales for a couple years. We were selling a very sophisticated software development environment called IEF. Which was called CASE tools. Back then, that was a term, meant computer-aided systems engineering software. And I was in a remote area because they got moved to Phoenix, and I always had to schedule systems engineers to come in from out of town when I wanted to present to a client, which was very frustrating. So I convinced my management and Texas Instruments to allow me to go through their software development course for the tool, which I was the first person in TI history where they made the exception to allow somebody in sales to go through an engineering course in there. So they flew me out to Plano, and I was there for a month learning their software development tools. And then I started selling, and of course, sales took off because I could just whip out my gigantic laptop back then and sit down with a developer.
How big are we talking here?
I don't know, 12, 14 pounds. And,
oh, my God.
You know.
And, so probably like a 13-inch monitor, but like triple the thickness of like a current
laptop. Oh, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, they were very heavy back then. Yeah.
And probably the processing power was like nothing like now, like not even close.
Oh, God. It was like, you know, it was like a, you know, an iPhone from 6 years ago was 100 times faster.
That's crazy. It is, it's funny. There's that Moore's Law or whatever it is. It's like 2X,
Moore's Law, exactly.
It goes down by 3X. All right, continue. Right.
Anyway, so I ended up learning how to develop in IF, and I learned how to do, you know, because it was all big, sophisticated mainframe stuff, and these were big companies and enterprise, I learned a database design and development at a big company level. And this is the kind of stuff that I just consumed back then. And I just loved it. Well, you know, that was sort of appealing to my physics side of my brain. And then I started just killing it in sales there. And then I eventually left Texas Instruments to become a project manager and a consultant for IAF for Intel, projects at Intel, Allied Signal, Arizona Public Service, Motorola, because I was very highly trained on the beta products, the very newest versions, and nobody in town was. So, of course, really high billing rates. And so I did that for a couple of years. And while I was doing at Texas Instruments at the end, and while I was doing this consulting work, I started my own software company, not in IAF, but in a Windows product for logistics, route distribution, inventory management. And I partnered with one of the guys at Texas Instruments. And we just started this company sort of as a lark because we knew we always wanted to have a software company. And we thought, well, we could just sort of put something on the market and, you know, in a couple months and then get kind of a monthly revenue off of it, kind of an annuity, and then get our feet wet and then really decide what we wanted to do software wise. And despite every effort on both our parts, we ended up growing this fledgling concept into 800 customers in 22 countries over the next 8 years. And then I ended up selling it to a publicly traded firm out of Toronto in 2000. So that was my first venture into being a software entrepreneur.
What does IEF mean? That was the one part I was
IEF, Information Engineering Facility, is what the name of the product, what IEF stands for. That was
what,
the product.
Like, what is that? Like, let's break that down, because I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
Right now. Oh, okay. You're building a big a mainframe system for American Express. They were one of the big users of this system, right? And they have this internally, and they want to have the code was generated. The system would generate the code from models, so they would design almost like a CAD model, but it was for coding. They would create these visual models of processes and data and interaction and human interaction and screens. And then it would then take that model and generate the code. And then if you wanted to make changes to it, you make changes to the model. The idea being that now the code is much more maintainable. It's much faster to build because you're working in these visual models instead of writing code by hand.
Handling American Airlines, for example, is that like handling like checking in, ticketing, like all these different processes?
Yeah,
that's how they were building out the system to handle all that.
Yes, that's how exactly. Like, not American Airlines, but in particular. But yes, systems like that, right?
Okay.
All those screens and all the functionality and all the database management and then background processing that they would do every night. All of those systems were built using these visual models using this product IEF.
In terms of timeline, like what years are we talking where that became a thing? Like, because I just like
late 80s.
Okay.
Late 80s
Oh,
is when
wow.
it became a
Okay.
thing, and it stayed a thing through the late 90s. That
So
way
it's
of
not how they
developing.
operate. They don't operate this way anymore.
No. The problem with those models is they were just really monolithic. The systems were just huge and highly integrated. And as technology changes really fast, right, and it just keeps changing faster and faster, those systems could not adapt to all the new types of technology. I mean, they had a big
Okay.
problem adapting just to Windows screens instead of green screen Unix type stuff, right? They had a huge effort trying to go from COBOL to more modern languages. And then by the mid 2000s, there was still just a lot of systems out there, but their sales had pretty much died out.
You know, I heard a story, and I think this is actually recently, like in my own experience, like renting a car, these car rental places, their like software is like 40 years old. Like
Oh,
some of
yeah.
the, like some of this booking stuff, like I go online
Yeah.
for whatever rental car company, and I have all my information, my address, credit card, phone number, all this stuff. I go there to get my car at the airport, and I have to tell them everything again. I'm like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Like I've already like, and like the line is like super long because everybody has to go to this thing. It's because
Yeah.
the actual software or whatever they're using at the desk, the guy's using is like so old
Right.
that this is like what, and like it blows my mind. And it seems like basically what you're talking about, except these guys never, Enterprise or whoever this was, never upgraded, like never updated the
Or
thing.
they built it in the 70s, or they built it in the 80s, or 90s. And they've just
Right.
continued to maintain it and enhance it on that existing. It could, because imagine,
Because
what
the
they have
cost
to
will be
do to
high.
pull all those little,
Yeah.
all the minutiae business rules out of there, which may not all be documented properly. And so it's all locked up in the code, and it's a huge risk to try to replace those systems.
I
Major risk.
know, but it's making the customer experience awful when you get to go stand
No
this
question.
ridiculous line because of this. Because this could have
Right.
all been handled. Like if you just bite the bullet and do it, this whole
Yep.
process will move so much more efficiently. You know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
I mean,
honestly, like for anybody listening to this, here's if you need a business idea and you've got the skills or the money to do it, here's your hit.
yeah.
Because if you start a rental car company that you don't have to stand in line for 30 minutes when you get there, you have a huge advantage. I know that's a massive barrier to entry, but still, people will be.
Have you ever used Turo? Turo?
I know what it is, but I've heard a lot of bad stories, mostly from the owners of the cars. Like somebody rented my car and destroyed it. And like, and then it becomes a whole thing of the insurance and
Right.
like
Yeah, but that's
it
the owner of the
seems like,
car.
yeah, it's true, but I can
And
see,
there's a
I can, yeah.
lot, and there's a
Yeah.
lot of people in Turo that are companies with fleets of cars that are renting them. And they just buy lots of cars of different types that they know are popular, and they rent them. And I've rented cars from Turo many times, and it is such an easy experience. You don't have to deal with a rental car company. You're dealing with
Yeah,
an app. All you do deal with an app,
it's
and you can
Uber for
rent
renting.
any
It's
kind of car you want.
literally Uber for renting a car.
It's right. It's like that. I mean, you can rent any kind of car you want. That's what I like about it. So if I want to try something different, a brand new something that I haven't driven before, or maybe something older that's just really cool, whatever it is, I can find it on Turo, and I can
Right,
rent it.
yeah.
And it's usually not, and usually it's less expensive than if I were to rent something comparable at a rental car company.
No,
So I think
that's
it's
something to keep in mind next time. I don't like rent cars like in my city just to try new cars because I don't really care. Like I'm not a car guy. Like, oh, I want to drive this car. But like the next time I'm traveling, I need to keep that in mind because yes, the whole experience of like having to go to the rental car thing. Like I could just next time, I don't know where you get the car. I guess you have to go to the location the
It
car is being
depends on
kept.
the car owner and the airport. You can
Right.
get them usually often right at the airport parking lot. They may charge you for that parking fee, but typically, but they don't all. And then, or if not, then it's someplace that you can get to without, that's maybe off airport, but in one of the parking garages that you would normally park at the airport. And so they'll tell you, it depends on which airport and what you're
Yeah.
renting and who the owner is. But and a lot of them will give you the option, do you want it at the airport? And they just charge you a little more, or at the offsite right near the airport. and then
Yeah.
they charge you less. But I love Turo, just because
Yeah,
I get much better cars than what I get
it's
from a rental
literally
car.
Airbnb for cars. It's just
Yeah, right, exactly.
the difference is like a moving vehicle and the risk of something goes wrong is a lot higher than just a home where somebody might accidentally burn it down. You know what I mean? Like the risk is so much higher
For
because
the owner.
for the owner, yes, 100%,
But
because
it's really not, because if you're a rental car company and you own those cars, you have the same problem with those cars that
yeah,
you do,
you don't hear the
except,
stories. You don't hear the horror stories, but
well,
I guess it
but you
comes
don't hear the
down
horse.
to, yeah, sorry.
You don't hear the horror stories at the big rental car companies, because they just absorb it, right? And they have departments that deal with those types of problems. Whereas if you're an individual, and you're renting your car on Turo, that's a high risk proposition because you have one or two cars. But if you're doing it as a business and you have 15 or 20 cars, you can get insurance right on Turo, just like you normally do. And the person who's renting you the car can require additional information if you're not carrying the insurance, for example. But anyway, I have found it to be a great experience. And I rented a sports car that had really low profile wheels. And when I parked it back at the airport, I got too close to the curb and brushed these super expensive rims up against the curb. And so I ended up having to pay $800 to replace the wheel.
Oh,
And it was on me. I did it. I
but
could
I
have,
feel like
and it wasn't
you're
worth reporting to my insurance because I didn't take their insurance, which would have been another $40 or whatever to get the full insurance that would cover everything. And my insurance covered would have covered it, but I didn't want to. It wasn't worth it because it was almost the amount of the deductible. So I just paid it.
right. But I also feel like you're a pretty smart guy and like you kind of knew the risk of like even trying to drive this car in the first place. You're like, there's a good chance I'm gonna dig something up with even being as careful as I possibly can because this is the sports car and that's what happens.
Well, those really low profile
And low
rims.
profile, yeah, when you're that low to the
Normally
ground,
you rub
yeah.
up against the curb and it's just the tire hitting the curb, not the rim. And I didn't slam into it. I just slightly dragged it, but that's all it takes on those rims to
Yeah.
basically ruin the finish on it. And then there's no fixing it. I mean, it worked just fine, but you can't, whole
It's a
point of those
cosmetic
rims is
fix.
that
Yeah,
they
it's a
look, they're
cosmetic fix.
cosmetic and there's no
Yeah.
fixing them. Right. And I didn't bring my black spray paint with me to try to say I wouldn't do that anyway, but it just as a humorous thing. I mean, they had to replace the wheel and it was my fault. So, but that would have happened at a rental car company if I didn't take their insurance. My
Yeah.
credit card has insurance, but again, it has a deductible. It wasn't worth it. So anyway, this is way off the topic of whatever we're talking about, right?
We went on a tangent there. Hopefully people listening aren't like, okay, what are these guys doing?
Right.
All right, so back to your company. So now we're in 2007. You founded TechYZ. Talk about that
Techies.
now. Or Techies, yeah. I keep calling TechYZ. Techies, yeah.
I founded Techies to basically do contract development. And that was 18 years ago almost. And we've been doing software development now for that whole time, for all different, for startups and scale-ups, existing companies that need workflow automation, and the technology has changed obviously a lot during that time. I mean, we were pre-iPhone when we started Techies, and then of course the iPhone revolution, and then the mobile, I mean mobile phones, the smartphones, and then the cloud computing, right? And these were all major shifts. Because at first, most people won't remember this, but nobody would get on the cloud because how can you possibly relinquish your data up to this cloud thing that seems so secure they're going to lose it, right? Companies didn't trust it. And now people think you're crazy if you don't have your data in the cloud. Because on if you have it on your own server, that's like so, 2015. It's so yesterday. It's just not
Yeah,
secure.
no,
You have
100%.
maintenance
Like,
costs. Right. And
yeah.
now,
I mean, me more of like an individual personal level. Like, I use Dropbox, and it's like, I'm sure they have servers around the world. Like, there's no way unless you have the most sophisticated like strategic attack of all time that you could ever take this company down, because they're going to have backups everywhere and all this stuff. And it's like,
and they have
I'm never worried again about losing my data because it's on there. Like, I'll never just use, like, just keep it on a PC ever again, because it's just way too risky.
Right. And and your chances of losing the data on your own server are huge. Anything could happen to take it out, right? Or you being hacked. Those companies, their level of security is so extreme. I mean, you hear about companies getting hacked, mostly, you know, companies with big databases, not necessarily, but these big server companies, you don't hear about it from companies like Google or Amazon or Dropbox or Microsoft. They don't get hacked because they have such extreme stringent security requirements, because they're running, you know, many different governments' data, right? And huge corporations. And all they have to do is get hacked once and they're going to lose everybody. So anyway, so they're very secure, but none of these revolutions has anywhere near the impact that AI is having.
And let's talk about that, because I'm curious on, like, where, like, obviously, like, I don't even know that much about AI. I mean, I've used a couple tools and things, but yeah, just like expand our knowledge on everything AI here.
Okay. I mean, Satya Nadella, he's the CEO of Microsoft. Like 2 years ago when he was asked about AI, somebody said, is this like the biggest thing since GPS? And he said, no. He said, this is the biggest thing since the invention of fire. And it's like that. I mean, in terms of the impact that it's going to have on, that it's having already, and that it will have on the world, and the speed at which it's evolving. So I know there's all kinds of fears. We can have that whole conversation if we want, but I think it'd be more interesting to talk about exactly what's going on, what we're doing with it, you know, or what people are doing with it, both in companies and in terms of products. And there, you hear a lot of hype. Everybody's trying to come out with some AI tool that's built around ChatGPT or Claude or Perplexity or Google Gemini or whatever. And some of them are really smart and have huge value to some particular population, and others are very gimmicky, right? And so just depends on what, you know, the genesis of a product. And I'll give you a few examples that we're building internally, and my understanding of startups and what makes a startup really work. One of the best things, you know, not looking at the unicorns and the 0.001 percenters, but the typical startups that find a path to revenue and become successful companies are those where the founder came from an industry and in that industry, they were dealing with a problem on a daily or weekly basis. So it's always top of mind, and they can articulate how much that problem impacts them personally from a perception perspective. And they can talk about how much it's costing them because of that problem. They can articulate that. They have a really good understanding of it. And that founder happens to be in an industry where there's lots of people that are doing exactly what they're doing and struggling with the exact same problem they're struggling with. And that the founder has reached to those people, you know, some reach, so that you can validate product market fit and validate that they're struggling with the problem in the same way that there aren't good solutions to address that problem. Either there aren't good solutions, or the solutions are not consumable because they're targeted to enterprise and they're a small business or something like that. That founder decides they want to fix that problem with software, and they figure that they can probably sell this to other people like them. That's the foundation of a startup that has a much, much better chance at finding a path to revenue and success than the average startup. Because in the software world, it's like 95 to 98% of software startups fail. I mean, it's a massive number. And it's just very difficult. And a lot of them, it's because for a couple of reasons. One, they come at it from the idea of, they have this idea that they think is cool and everybody's going to love it because they would love it. Those startups rarely ever make it. Those probably 99% fail. But the ones that have a really good idea and they have a market that they understand really well and a product, they still fail in large numbers because because they get into the belief system that they're solving a problem that everybody needs also, because they understood why they needed it. But instead of doing all the hard work up front, they go and build the product out and they put all the features into it and they spend a year to get their MVP out, which is a minimum viable product or your very first version. And then they usually give that away for free so that they can get feedback and spend another year or year and a half getting it ready to market. And then finally, 2 years later, they start marketing the product and find out nobody wants to buy it, or they don't, or they can't sell it in enough numbers, or the cost of acquisition is so high that they can't get to a level of viability. And I always say, and this is kind of a golden rule in SaaS, in the SaaS world, 3 to 1, if you look at how much the lifetime value of a customer versus how much it costs you to acquire that customer, which we call cost of acquisition. If you're not at a 3 to 1 ratio or higher, then you don't have a viable business. So, and most SaaS companies don't ever even get to a fraction of that. So that's why they fail in such large numbers. And they fail because they just wait too long to start to sell their product and validate product market fit.
Well, it almost seems like your MVP should, like, they're not doing MVP. They're doing like a more of a maximum MVP. Like they're not making the minimum viable product. They're making the maximum viable product. And it's like, no, you need to make like
A
the
lot of
most
them do.
basic thing. That's actually very relatable to just even like engineering, like from physical products that I've made and I've worked for inventors. It's like, hey, make the very cheapest, most basic thing you can. Don't even sell it. Just fake sell it and see what people want to pay for it, because you got to fail fast here. You got to find out quickly. Like, and if people like your thing and it's really crappy at the beginning, okay, now you're on something. But if they have no interest and it's lousy, I think the harder thing decision is like
Fail
when they,
fast and cheap.
right.
Fail fast
Well,
and
I
cheap.
think the hardest thing is like when it's not necessarily a fail, but it's also not like an obvious win. Like that's the hardest one to keep to decide on. It's like, okay, you make your MVP, a true minimum viable product, and the reaction is mixed. It's like, well, some people like it, some people don't. You don't know what they're willing to pay, but it's also really crappy. It's early. What do you do then? That's a harder decision, because now you're in the middle of the road. Or maybe it's just like, hey, if it's not a slam, if it's not a slam dunk, maybe don't even pursue it.
So it's probably going to fail if you're in the middle of the road. So if you're not, because you haven't either either you haven't found the right messaging to or you're not offering the right value to the early adopter. But if you're in the middle of the road, you're not getting to that, equivalent 3 to 1 value. I don't know what it is in a physical product world, because it's the cost of acquiring a customer versus what the product costs, what you're selling it for, right? So if you're not getting it at a high enough profit margin that you know that this, and with enough volume that you know you can build and grow, then you're going to fail. So that middle road thing is probably a bad place to be. It's not any really any better than the total failure, because it's still failure. If you have a really clear set of metrics and what success looks like, and you don't get there, then you're not there, period. And you should pivot at that point. Something's not right. Early adopter you're going after is not right. Something about the product, maybe you're getting feedback that's indicating that you don't quite have the right product, but maybe people are telling you what you do need. So then you pivot to that. And I don't think you should build an MVP. I think you should build a, in software world, a design prototype. Looks like real software, but it's not real software. You can demo it to people, show them, and it looks like you've built it. And that's a fraction as much as building your MVP in terms of cost. But you can show all the functionality in a design prototype that you may not put in your MVP. So we call that a pre-launch sale. And then you go out and you offer a high enough value opportunity for them to buy in early. And if they're not buying, then there's a problem with your business model. And we try to figure out what that is. And pivoting is quick and cheap. And getting to that design prototype is quick and cheap as compared to building your MVP. So my goal is to get to where we're testing the product market fit sales through pre-launch sales within 3 months of starting the design process. So you got a marketing funnel, you've identified the early adopter, you've done all the niche analysis, you've done the design prototype, you've wired it up so it looks like it's real. Then you go out and start, and you offer some kind of really high value option to the person buying it, and you know who that early adopter is based on your research. And if you're right that the cost of what, because there's two things that a founder's got to figure out. who's that early? The number one thing is, oh, it's one thing they got to figure out. Who is the early adopter? And you know that by finding that stakeholder in a particular niche whose perceived impact because of the problem you're solving is really high, and in parallel, the cost of that problem to them is really high. Those are two independent numbers. People don't see them as independent, but they are. You can have a problem that costs a lot, but there's no perceived impact to the stakeholder because they go, everybody in my industry has been dealing with this for 20 years, you know, and it's not something I have to fix. It's not going to get me more customers. Yeah, it'll save me money, but it's not worth the, you know, it's like no perceived impact to
it's
that.
It's like the rental car software situation where
exactly
like, they know it's a problem, but like it's not.
If the cost is too, the risk for them, it's just like it's too risky to deal with that, even though the cost to us is massive. The risk is too high, and we're not gonna right until everybody else does, and now they're starting to lose business, and so now all of a sudden,
or you know, we start using the Turo app and we don't rent from them anymore because of all the time it takes at the airport to do it. And it's like, right. Why, you know, if it's going to cost me just heck, if it's going to cost me 20% more, but I'm going to save an hour on each end between returning the car and picking up the car,
yeah,
I'm probably willing to pay that much because time is money. Right. And so,
Actually costs less with Turo. So, you know, and it doesn't take any longer to pick it up than at a rental car. So, but you're right. That's exactly correct. So now you can have the same opposite too, where the perceived impact is really high. I hate that. It just drives me crazy. I would do anything to get rid of it. But the actual cost, when you go to quantify the cost, is very low to that person. So they're not going to pay a lot for it. I'll do anything for it until you ask me to give you a lot of money for it. I'm not going to pay that for it. It is, you know, it's not worth it. So you got to get both those numbers high, the perception and the cost. Like if all of a sudden Turo was wiping out these rental car companies, I guarantee you people's jobs would be on the line. And now their perceived impact, because they haven't done something about this, becomes really high, and it outscales the risk, and they're going to want to do something. But we're not, you know, that's, I don't think there's going to be too many startups that are trying to replace the rental car industry. Most of the startups that we deal with are really much more tactical in what they're trying to accomplish. Sometimes they're really strategic and huge, but most of the time, but those are very risky, the big strategic and huge ones. I mean, it's just so rare that that a company like that takes off, right? So
that is like an Uber, right? Like somebody that's going to change the industry completely. I watched the movie on that, and it was like, you know, super interesting, obviously, because like it was such a revolutionary concept. Like, oh, who's going to like drive around strangers? And it's like, oh, let's find out. Right. Yeah.
But it was the same sort of thing. They were solving a problem that they struggled with themselves in San Francisco on a daily basis, right? Trying to get cabs easily, you know, that they could get, you know, that, you know, it was just impossible to get cabs at the time. And so they thought, well, why don't we have this on-demand service?
Now you have the self-driving cars, which actually last summer, I was in San Francisco, first time in my life I've been there. And that was unbelievable. Like I could not believe how well it worked. Like this has to be the most chaotic environment. I'm in Chinatown in San Francisco. It's the most insane chaotic, and it worked perfectly. Like obviously they're erring on the side of caution. It was almost like a little too safe, but like it worked. It showed up. Mm-hmm. Getting in the car was a bit of a pain, like a little bit, but like it didn't hit anybody. Like it waited for people. Like it drove. Like I don't understand how this is only existing. It must be like a massive cost to build one of these cars, because
you're talking about Waymo, right?
Yeah, Waymo. Yeah.
Yeah, Waymo's expensive. Waymo cars are because they've got all the radar built into them, right? I think they're like $150,000 a car. They're pretty expensive, but it's half the cost to take a Waymo than it was to take. In fact, Uber costs now are starting to get driven down in cities where Waymos are. I was in a Waymo just this weekend.
Is Waymo only in San Francisco? Because like Charlotte, we don't have it, and like I'm just wondering why others
they have
them
in Phoenix. They have it in Los Angeles now, which is new. They don't have them in San Diego yet. I don't know what. And in each city they put them in, they usually start in a smaller area and they slowly expand the radius of how far out it'll go.
Right.
And they are still not driving on freeways, at least not in Phoenix, which is annoying because I have to go, you know, it's a 25 minute drive from the airport to my mother's house. That's why I go there every month. And it's a 50 minute drive on a Waymo because it's all surface streets, which on the other hand, I don't have to, I don't, it's half the cost, even though it takes that much longer to drive. I don't have to talk to the worry that I'm ignoring the Uber driver or talk to them. And I don't have to, and there's no tip to leave because there's nobody you're tipping. So, I mean, there's a, right. And it's comfortable. I can sit there and work or play chess or play whatever, right, while I'm driving up there. So, this will be the year of self-driving cars because, you know, Tesla's self-driving capabilities are already really good too. And you've got Uber with their own self-driving stuff. So this will be the year that they start to really hit the market. Maybe.
Is AI involved in self-driving cars? Like, is that part of it?
Oh, it's all AI. It's all AI.
I figured because it's literally learning from the environment.
Yep.
Over time. You know, and what's interesting too.
Yep.
Is that like, and let's say you take two of these cars, almost like a person, and you put one of them in Phoenix and one of them in Charlotte, like very different weather, very different conditions. Like, we have a lot of humidity and moisture. Like this morning there was fog. Like, these are things that, like, Phoenix, I doubt has fog. It's a desert, right? Like, there's no moisture there. So, like, I wonder if the cars learn how to operate in fog and rain versus, like, just, you know, clear conditions because it's Phoenix. Like, would these two cars actually have different driving profiles because of what they've experienced over time?
Oh, I'm sure. I haven't delved into them that deeply, but they would have to. They'd have to understand how to drive in fog and, you know, in San Francisco area, they have to know how to do that. They couldn't be on the road when it was foggy, and then people would stop relying on them. And these types of services, it's all about building up, you know, trust and credibility with your customers. So, but now I have a prediction. If you want to, one of the few AI predictions I feel confident about, because it's very hard to predict AI, but I do predict that self-driving cars are going to become a thing this year. And in the next few years, they will become will hit a critical mass or a tipping point because there'll be so many of them on the road, whether it's your own car and you tap the button that says, okay, you know, whatever service I've subscribed to can take my car now and I'll make money because I don't need it for the next couple hours. And it just leaves your driveway. Right. And, or because all these companies are buying fleets of cars for self-driving cars and then putting them on whatever the Tesla network or the Waymo network or however they're doing it.
Give me a couple stock picks. So I can,
well, I don't know about that, but I can tell you how it's going to have a not viral impact.
Like, I understand what you're saying. It's going to become where it's more normal than not normal to have one or to be involved.
And there'll be a tipping point where it happens really fast. All of a sudden, people stop buying cars because it's much cheaper to get in one of these cars because there's a lot of them and you can get one in a minute, not in 10 minutes, like it is with Uber a lot of the time, but in a minute in major cities. You know, rural areas is a different story, but in a major city or even in suburbs, you'll be able to get one very fast because they'll be everywhere. And you don't have to have insurance.
These are going to be independent companies then that rent these out.
Turo, people, individuals that have two cars, companies that have 100 cars, you know, it'll be like that. And there'll be networks where that you just basically put your car in that network and you're being reimbursed kind of like an Uber and it'll be a dispatching network. It might be Tesla, it might be Waymo, it might be Uber will probably have something like this. And then there won't be any need anymore for all of a sudden these massive parking structures, you know, these 10-story parking structures or underground parking structures or stadium parking structure, they'll all be empty.
But like the cars that do this would have to be like new cars or Tesla type cars, like older cars, like they wouldn't be able, you wouldn't try to retrofit, you know, a 1999.
No. It has to be new
Civic
cars.
To this. Like, yeah, yeah. It has to be.
Newer cars. Any Tesla built from like 2019 or 2020 on is auto driving capable. So I don't remember what year they put in all the sensors that they needed
Right.
to be able to do that. But they're all auto driving capable. Everything that's been coming out for
But
the
the
last few
majority of the
years.
cars on the road are not Teslas. Like we're talking, Teslas are 5% tops. Like they're very low percentage. So like, yeah, no, like to replace, like you'd have to have a lot more
Yeah,
of
but in
these
the but
types
in
of
the next
cars. Yeah.
5 years, yeah, but over the next 4 to 6 years is which when I'm predicting this, you know, many of the car, well, if you think of, you know, 2000, you know, the majority of 2010 to 2015 cars will all be replaced with newer cars. And so
True.
the it you'll hit a point where not the majority of cars, but you don't need the majority of cars. Remember, people go from one place to another, they park and it sits there for hours, like at work. You don't need that anymore. So those cars will be repurposed all over the place. During traffic hours, you know, then you might have ride shares or something like that until the massive cars picks up to be able to take everybody exactly where they need to go when they need to go. But you won't need as many cars on the road. You know, at you'll need as many cars on the road at one time, but you won't need all those cars on the road, you know, but they all become available as soon as they drop you off. And
Right,
so,
I get that. I get that.
yeah,
Yeah.
right. And so they'll have smart scheduling stuff where they say if you go between, you know, we'll give you a huge discount if you're like go to work hourly. So you'll have staggered start and end times at work just to make if you're going to work. And more work is done remotely now. So there's less of a need for that as well. I just think you'll hit a tipping point and all of a sudden the need for parking structures will be gone and architecture and build. So people that own those right now are going to be like the people that owned taxis 7, 8 years ago. You know, all of a sudden there was a tipping point. Now taxi industry got wiped out. It'll be the same sort of thing.
Yeah, it's crazy around here. Like some of these banks, like, Charlotte's a big banking town. Like some of these banks like, built these humongous buildings, and then COVID happened, and like they're empty. And like they're like, I have friends that work there, and they're like, yeah, they're making us go back to the office. And it's like literally the only reason is like it's a sunk cost fallacy. Like they sunk the money into this building, and they're just telling people that so they can feel better about the money they spent because they realize like everybody knows that it doesn't make a difference. Actually, most people are more productive not being in the office. And they're making people go back just to make them like the management people feel better about like their decision to build this thing. It's beyond stupid. But yeah, we had these huge structures and like I don't think they're ever full anymore because even with these
No.
mandates, people are still working remote. Like it's a lot of hybrid schedules, so
They'll be converted to condos, a lot of them. Because, and even those like in New York City right now, they've just got a huge glut of condos that nobody's living in. So, and office space that's empty and all of that stuff because of the remote working. But I was going to talk about like some practical things, like what we're doing internally. So we're doing a number of things. One of the things we do better than most software development firms, and I only say that because I've heard this feedback many times, not only from clients that are looking at estimates from other companies, but also from other software development firms, because I network with a bunch of other CEOs of software development firms. And I say we are really detailed and elaborate in how we do our estimates. It's something that we sort of, it's sort of a, you know, branding point for us. And they say, yeah, we are too. And they say, let me see yours. And I show them an estimate. They go, oh, no, we don't do estimates anywhere near that level of detail. And we just do because we want to be really accurate and it takes, and it's expensive to do it. So one of the things we're doing is building an AI model that will mimic our estimation process and even improve on it. So because it's costly to build these estimates right now because it takes our most expensive people, spending many hours to estimate a project, to the level of detail that we do it. Here's,
Oh wow, so you're spending like a lot of man hours just to create an estimate. You don't even know if you're going to get the
Oh yeah.
job. That's crazy.
No, it's just cause some costs as far as we're concerned. I figure we want to know what we're getting into. We want the client to know what they're getting from us. And we also are constantly trying to be exceptional in what we do in every respect. And when you're really exceptional what you do, that means you have all these artifacts which that you produce that companies that aren't exceptional don't produce, right? One of those for us is estimates. And it's one that we can easily that we can well not easily, but that we can build a an AI model around to produce them for us in the future and even improve on what we've been doing in terms of accuracy and identifying potential gaps that we might have missed when we're doing estimates. So that's one thing. And that's going to turn into a SaaS product once we use it for a while and we can see it's really working as well as or better than we need it to. And then we can start to provide it to other organizations to do estimates using our methodology. And I've had a number of development companies tell me that this is something that they would desperately want because it would give them a leg up on competitors, and eventually everybody will do estimating this way. And so if you don't, you'll be at a loss. That's kind of how I see these types of markets. Another one is we've done a lot recently with voice AI. In particular, one of our clients has a voice bot, which is a nurse, which is has access to a patient's medical records, and is and the target customer is indigent population that like on Medicaid, people are poor or vulnerable or that need a lot of monitoring. And so with wearable devices like a watch, it can identify outlier situations that are indicating that there may be a potential acute situation that needs to be addressed by some professional medical person, and then call the patient and have a normal, friendly conversation with the patient about, you know, I noticed your blood pressure spiked or your heart rate just spiked in an unusual way. Are you doing something strenuous? I just want to make sure you're okay.
Oh, and that's an AI call.
It's an AI call, a phone call AI, okay. And it's very natural. They go, yeah, I, you know, as a matter of fact, I just climbed 4 flights of stairs, and they, you know, and the nurse might say, oh, that's a relief because I was concerned. I'll keep an eye on it. Do you want me to call you back?
I've made some calls recently where the person who picked up,
yeah,
I think it was AI, but I don't even know. Like I was like,
the person who picked up was AI. That's a new one.
Yeah. Like I called and it was like, I don't think this is a person. I thought 100%.
Oh, I love that.
Sure. Yeah,
I need to do like, that. I need to make that AI so that basically an AI screener.
This tool definitely exists. I think Google does it or something, but like this tool definitely exists. There's some AI answering services out there.
So what we're doing, because this feature is very cool, right? This capability. So we're building our own AI prototype for a voice that we can train on specific vertical topics with the idea that, you know, this might be a client that wants this to be a customer support AI tool that they can offer to their clients. And then we'll show them some examples. So while we were, and the first version of this will be out like in a week, you know, just for ourselves, for prototype, for being able to do demos for potential new clients. But one of the things we were starting to brainstorm around is, you know, what my director's operations said, why don't we give this to our customers and then they could generate bug reports or feature requests, which would then automatically email to us without them having to type it all out. And then we started brainstorming some more and somebody said, wait a minute, why don't we just tie it into our project management system for that company and train it on everything in the project management system about their project for their company, so that if they report a bug, it can say, well, actually that bug was reported about 2 weeks ago from so-and-so and it's marked as a medium priority. Do you want to raise that priority? And then if they say, yeah, raise it to high, they say, okay. And then it updates the project management system. And now that's a higher priority and it prevents us or the client from entering duplicates, because that happens a lot. When you're doing bug reporting, it's the same bug's been reported a little bit differently, a couple different ways from some people. And then later on, you're reconciling all these things because you kind of get a mess in the bug. Or they may say, you know, I want to suggest a feature. And they say, actually, that feature was suggested 6 months ago, and it's scheduled to be in a build in 2 weeks from now, you know, that sort of thing. That is going to be huge for our clients. It will be huge for us because we won't have to parse every single request that comes in immediately and figure out whether we need to put it in for the clients that don't add their own bugs. The ones that do add their own bugs, we don't have to worry about them adding duplicates and plus the AI can ask questions about it if it doesn't feel it's articulated properly, right? To make sure that it's documented the bug properly or the new feature properly. So that's an example. And that is a feature I think that just about every development shop would want. and so that they can offer that to their clients. It'll just, you know, it just it, from a marketing perspective, it's cool. From a functional perspective, to keep things very clean and efficient in the project management system, it's just fantastic. So we got very excited about this about a week ago, and so our first version of this prototype's coming out next week. It won't have that in it, but it'll only take us another 7 to 10 days to create a project management a tied in integrated version, because we're using AI to generate a lot of code now, and the speed at which we can deliver things now has
So, are
gone
you
up
using one of the
dramatically.
existing AI tools out there, or did you create your own
No,
to
we
do the
use
current?
existing ones because these large language models are really smart. And sometimes we build what's called a RAG model, where we build our own AI database on a particular smart topic, on a particular topic like healthcare. And then it uses the large language model. The large language model is informed by this custom AI model.
Let's talk
So,
about large language model for just a second, because I think a lot of people may not know what that means.
okay, OpenAI, everybody, ChatGPT, everybody sort of that by now, I think. If not, please go hunt for ChatGPT and watch YouTube videos about it because it'll blow you away if you don't know about it. I have an infinite number of stories about how we use this stuff, how I use it personally all the time, my wife uses it for gardening, how, I mean, these are really, and ChatGPT is consistently staying the leader in many of the areas. There's Claude, Claude, which is a fantastic tool. There's Google Gemini, which is amazing. And Google has some very cool
Is that the
AI
one that
products.
shows that, like, when you Google something and now, like, this is like a newer thing? Like, at the top,
Yeah.
it's AI generated. That's Google Gemini.
That's Gemini. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's Gemini integrated into their search. Right. They also have some, Google has this thing called Notebook LM now. It is, they came out with that about 4 months ago. And you can upload, you can point it to your Google Drive and it'll look at your docs and your Google presentations. And you can give it a website as a source. You can give it YouTube videos as a source. And you can add all these different sources in there for to be able to, and then it assimilates it all. It's kind of like a dynamic RAG model, what I was just talking about. It creates its own mini AI model around your content, and then you can say summarize all this information into, you know, you can upload audio recordings, summarize all this, or give me an overview, or create a deep dive discussion for me, and it'll create a podcast with a man and a woman talking in very nuanced, kind of hip way, and it's, you can't believe that it's AI that's generated this discussion. And it understands all your information really incredibly well, and it does it very fast. So, in fact, I'm using it right now. I updated, uploaded like 15 interviews, the transcripts from 15 different podcast interviews, just like this one, because I'm doing speaking at a conference next month. It's human H2H human driven technology conference. And so I need to come up with what topic I'm going to be talking about. So I thought, okay, well, how about I've got all these podcasts and I've talked about startups in some, I focus on AI in some, I focus on being an exceptional software development team in some, you know, it depends on who the audience is and what they need to hear. And I focus on those topics because I've been doing this for so long. I have a lot I can, you know, draw from when I'm talking. And then I said, okay. And then I gave it the website link to Techies and to Launch First. And then I uploaded the conference description of what the conference is. And I said, I'm going to this conference and I am considering some topics. What would be the best topics? You know, give me some ideas for topics to talk about at this conference and why you think they're the best. And it gave me a fantastic list of topics, different ones based on all the stuff I've talked about, and explained why it thought I'd be good at that. And then it gave me references back to the things I've talked about in my interviews. And like I could click on it and go right to that point in a transcript in an interview where I was talking about that thing if I didn't remember something. And then I can say, okay, go ahead and I'm going to pick this topic and go ahead and create draft presentation for me, and it'll build the whole presentation for you. And then you can talk to it and have a conversation about what you want to change in it, and do what would normally take several days of work in the space of 20 minutes.
Damn, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's called Notebook LM if anybody wants to check. And one of the things I did was after I uploaded everything, I had them do this deep dive podcast creation. It's very cool. And I just listened to how these two podcasters were talking back and forth about me and my content and all the things I've talked about and what Techies does. And it was giving me some great ideas.
So this tool basically generated a podcast from other podcasts you've done.
It generated from the content I uploaded. Yeah, it didn't matter what the content was, right? It just took all that and it said, let's do a deep dive on this guy, David Hirschfeld, seems to be big in AI. And then she goes, I know, he's been doing it for a lot longer than most people. And then he said, yeah, I started like in 2014. That's like dog years in development time. Yeah. And they're like, okay, this is like a very nuanced conversation. It's very funny. And then they go into a lot of the things that I talked about and what we do as a company and in an interesting way, you know, because they're in a discussion format. Yeah. And the voices are all AI generated, but it sounds like two, a man and a woman podcasters talking to each other and feeding off each other in the discussion. It's amazing. I've been using this for 4 months. I'm still amazed every time I listen to one of these things.
I'm joking here, but I probably won't hear from the audience anyways, but like maybe I should just replace myself with an AI voice and just let it do its thing, you know? No, people want to hear my voice. I mean, I'm the voice of the show, you know. It's the engineering entrepreneur podcast. I've been doing it for 10 years. I mean, I guess I could get an AI.
You may have even heard a Notebook LM podcast episode that somebody uploaded in their podcast, because there were a bunch of people doing that when it first came out. I think they stopped doing it probably because the podcasting stations like Apple and places like that recognize it and don't really want to provide lots of distribution to something that wasn't really, you know, wasn't provided by somebody individually. Kind of like having
AI like imagine content. If every podcast became the same two voices talking to each other, like everyone's going to be like bored of that, right? One of the great things about the podcast, you know, universe, like the whole thing, is, you know, I have 10 different shows I listen to pretty frequently, and like the big value is that, you know, I get to hear different voices. Like it'd be boring if they're all the same AI voices.
It's organic and it's raw, right? Yeah, that's what I like about podcasting too. Even the ones that are really well coiffed, you know, and orchestrated, and it's still, there's a lot of, it's just raw content that people are, you know, people are saying and and sharing what they understand about things. And yeah, it's, and you know, and I get really cool insights off the podcast, just like what you're saying. But anyway, those are some examples of like practical things we're doing internally using AI. I have a few others, but I think I've given you plenty of ideas of how AI can be used in very practical terms, and how it can be integrated into companies, into personal life. We're using it to help startups get a faster track on who they should be marketing to, for example, and helping build their prototypes so much faster.
Very cool. All right, David. Well, we've talked for quite a while about a lot of
things. Yeah, we have.
And it's been fun. But let's get towards wrapping up. So I always like to ask the last couple of questions. What's your number one tip? So you've got a lot of experience in business, AI, software development. Like, you know, my audience is a lot of engineers, and it could be software developers as well. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of experience. What's your number one tip?
Okay. So I'm going to give two tips because it depends on whether
it's cool tip with that. Two tips is fine.
Okay. If you're a startup, don't believe in your, you know, you have to be trust yourself. And if you have vision and you have a product idea, right, you have to trust yourself and be confident that it wasn't a stupid idea, that there's an opportunity, but don't believe in it. Entepreneurs that come to me and they're wearing the black robe because they have this belief in their vision and they're going to share it with the world, I spend a lot of time trying to peel that black robe off and put a white coat on, and turn them into scientists about their business and clinicians, and get it and make everything metrics driven, with the idea that be in love with the problem and spend all your time talking to potential customers. Don't be in love with the solution. The solution is just the natural thing that mitigates the problem. That's tip number one. And it's a big shift in mindset for most entrepreneurs to make that leap from one to the other. The second one is, if you're not sure exactly how to work with speak to AI, or how you're going to use it, ask it how you should use it. Ask it if you're thinking that you want to start something new, or you want to create a garden in your backyard and you're not sure how to go about it. Ask it, what questions should I ask you? I want to create a garden in my backyard. What questions should I ask you? Here's where I and tell it where you live, and how old you are, because that will inform it that it might give you a different suggestion on what kind of garden you might want if you're trying to grow your own vegetables, for example. And then just have a conversation with it like a friend, where you're going back and forth, and you don't have to agree with what it said. To say, I don't agree with that for this reason. Why do you think that's the right reason? And it may say, you know what, now considering your reason, I'm going to take a different tack because I understand now what your perspective is. So just talk to it like a normal conversation, and you won't believe how much it can guide you in the things you're trying to get accomplished. So those are my two tips.
Very cool. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the AI thing is just so fascinating, and I love using the tools. All right, lastly, contact info. People want to get in contact with you. What's the best way?
Easiest way probably is just to go to my website, tekyz.com, which is, that's how we spell techies, tekyz.com. And there you can go and click on the info page and just send me a note saying you heard me on the podcast, and I'd love to talk to you. And then you can also email me directly. I don't put the email link in the shows, but I do share it. If you've listened to the podcast at the end, it's david@techies.com. That'll come right to my inbox. And again, just reference the podcast and let me know what you want to talk about, and we can get on a Zoom. You might have an idea, or maybe you're struggling with an existing software development company and you need some advice. Whatever it is, I'm happy to just be helpful, and I will just steer you in the direction if you need if that's all you need. And I'm happy to do that. There's no cost to it. And if you do have a project you want to pursue, and you've got a budget and this is something you really intend to do, I'll put together requirements with you and do that detailed estimate I was talking about, and it doesn't cost you anything. And you're not even obligated to use me to build the software. Once you have that estimate, you can go someplace else. It's just sort of how we operate. Anyway.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, David, thanks so much, and we'll catch everyone next time on the podcast.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate it.